BBC World Service. I'm Mike Williams with The Why Factor. Today, the Open Plan Office. Why do millions of us work in them, surrounded by others, side by side, hearing the same noises, breathing the same air? What are the benefits? What are the drawbacks? This is my office, 8 stories plus a basement or two, open plan. Thousands of people packed close together at rows and rows of desks. There's a handful of meeting rooms and a few sofas on every floor. And there's what they call the breakout areas too, soft chairs and low tables. So this is where I work. At least this is where I'm supposed to work. I'm trying to write a script. I'm trying to write this script, in fact, but there are constant distractions. This is what it sounds like. But for me, at least, this is what it feels like. Millions of us battle our way into work through the crowds, and millions of us end up in a place like this. And we're told the reason we work this way is because, well, because of ideas like this.
Workspace options.
Interaction.
Efficiency.
Choices.
Visibility.
Different work patterns.
Communication.
Autonomy.
Flexibility.
All beautiful ideas, but are these the real reasons? Franklin Becker is a social psychologist at Cornell University in the United States, and he thinks they are not.
The fundamental reason why Open Plan has taken root has nothing to do really with communication or collaboration or even flexibility. It has to do with the fact that you can reduce the amount of space per person to a significant extent in an open plan versus any kind of a closed cellular office. And just think about it. If I put you into a 6-foot by 6-foot or 6-foot by 8-foot completely enclosed office, the image that would come to mind to most people is not office, it's prison or jail cell. If I put you in an open plan, that doesn't have that kind of feeling. So I can reduce the amount of space that's required tremendously over a large organization, and that translates to very significant dollar savings. And I would argue that that is the real rationale for why open plan has taken off and become largely the norm.
The challenge of efficiency and economy is met.
Professor Alexei Marmot from the Bartlett School of Architecture in London.
It's also much easier to move people around. If somebody is promoted and they work in the open plan, and you still expect them to work in the open plan, you don't have to go scurrying around building them an office because they've been promoted to, for example, a more senior grade. And it's true that countries and cities where prices of real estate are extremely high tend to really focus on the efficiency of the workspace.
In churches and in temples, palaces and mosques, we've long had the technology to open up space in a building. More recently, the combination of steel and concrete has made it much cheaper and easier to do without the load-bearing interior walls. The architect Frank Duffy says the idea goes back a long way, at least as far back as the scribes copying ancient manuscripts by candlelight.
There have been open plan offices since the Middle Ages. If you go to monks in monasteries, in scriptoriums, places like that, so that's an idea that's been around for quite a long time.
Frank Duffy has been described as one of the fathers of the open plan office. He quite firmly and quite rightly points out that he's far too young for that.
The history is important. The idea of large numbers of people being gathered together doing clerical work, using things like typewriters and, you know, later on copying machines, is where the office started. The form was invented in North America in the latter part of the 19th century in a great burst of entrepreneurial activity that shaped the United States in the latter part of the 19th century.
Those early open plan offices were ideally suited to one thing in particular, supervision. Rows of desks neatly ordered, ranks of clerical workers at ledgers or typewriters, and an overseer on a raised platform. But in Northern Europe after World War II, there was a reaction against those hierarchical systems and against that regimentation.
It had to happen in Germany. I think fundamentally a reaction against Nazism, that you did not tell people what to do. There has to be a process of negotiation with those involved.
The new concept was known as Bureau Landschaft, the office landscape, and it grew as workers' councils spread across Europe, the people demanding a greater say in the way that factories and offices were run.
The arrangement of the desks was somehow organic. There were plants, lots of plants around the place. There was a thing called carpet, which had just been invented for the first time in the office. And there was an idea behind it, which was that the layout was based upon an intensive study of patterns of communication between different parts of the organization, different individuals. And that idea was taken so far as to affect the shape of the building, which is non-orthogonal. It was a complex or almost organic shape, which symbolized this idea that it was designed from inside out.
So there are good financial reasons for the geometry of an open-plan office, and there are theories to explain and justify them. Social theories about egality and research into ways of working. The open-plan office looks clean and modern on the drawing board, and the architectural models with their tiny little humans look neat and full of promise. But the real things are filled with real humans, full-sized and noisy and distracting.
Typically, the plan that you see around you right now is more like a open plan office where the managers and employees, the executives, call center, telemarketers, all of them are sitting on the same floor.
A telemarketing company in Mumbai in India.
It can be distracting when all of us have a lot of work to do at the same time. So everyone's phones continuously ring and everyone's on call at the same time. It's a lot of fun to sit next to your colleagues. We are really close. We can just talk, answer each other's phone calls if somebody is really busy. It's a lot of fun, like, talk about what we did over the weekend, what weekend plans we have. So it's really fun.
Well, actually, I mean, everybody sitting here faces a problem since there are a lot of people who make calls, you know, they get clients. So there's a lot of disturbance around, you know, if two people are talking. It's a problem for the third person talking on the phone or, you know, thinking something. That's sort of a distraction.
My name is Julian Treasure. I'm chairman of a company called The Sound Agency, and I also wrote a book called Sound Business, all about sound. So sound is my passion. There are four ways primarily sound affects us. First is cognitively. Nobody can understand two people talking at the same time. We have bandwidth for about 1.6 people talking. So our auditory bandwidth is pretty narrow. So it's very difficult to understand two people talking at the same
time.
Exactly. And it's also, I can tell you, pretty hard to talk when somebody else, is talking. You know, that drives you nuts because you can't concentrate. Now, that's key when we're talking about open plan offices, because if I'm trying to do work, it requires me listening to a voice in my head to organize symbols, to organize a flow of words and put them on paper, for example. And if you're talking at the same time, then you're taking out one of my 1.6, and I'm left with 0.6 in my head. That doesn't work very well. It reduces my productivity dramatically. And in fact, I mean, there's a range of numbers on this, from 5% reduction up to, I always quote the biggest one I've ever found, which is 66% reduction in productivity as a result of somebody else's voice occupying that key space in your head. Second way sound affects us is psychologically. We use music specifically for that purpose a great deal. We can use it to deepen a mood, or we can use it to counteract a mood. If we're feeling a bit blue, we can put on something happy. That's not the only sound that changes our mood, though, of course. Birdsong, for example. Many people find birdsong deeply reassuring. We've learned of hundreds of thousands of years that when the birds are singing, we're safe. So if we hear birdsong, it calms us at a deep level. It's only if they suddenly stop singing that we know something bad is usually about to happen. The third way sound affects us is behaviorally. At the most basic level, we move away from unpleasant sound if we can. The fourth way sound affects us is physiologically. Sound affects breathing, heart rate, even hormone secretions. So if there's a sudden noise, that will suddenly cause hormone secretions. You'll go into fight-flight mode. which is noradrenaline, cortisol, those kind of hormones.
They're known as the stress hormones, and there's evidence that constant elevated levels of them in our bloodstream can damage our health in the long term. Telephones ringing and email beeping and other people's conversations take up space in the brain where we process sound. And there's a seemingly paradoxical solution that's being tried in some offices. To cut down on distracting noises, they're actually adding more noise to the mix. This is called pink noise. It may sound random, but it has very specific properties, power and density and frequency. Its profile is similar to falling rain or wind in the trees, and companies are now piping it into their offices to mask distracting sounds.
When it comes to paying attention to what you're doing, whether it's juggling numbers or words in your head, if there are extraneous distractions, whether it's sights or sounds in the background, the attentional systems of the brain will automatically take some of your executive control, your cognitive capacity, away from what you're doing to focus, even if it's subconsciously, on what's going on around you.
This is Jack Lewis, a neuroscientist and broadcaster too.
So we did an EEG experiment, that's electroencephalography, in the middle of an open plan office. So that involves putting sort of a rugby scrum cap on the head, which is studded with electrodes, which can pick up the very, very low-intensity electrical activity that emanates from the brain. And you could see the activity bursting across the brain at the moment that anything happened in the background.
Jack, I'm sorry, I think we're becoming a bit of a distraction ourselves. Let's just move down here a second. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Fundamentally, whether or not you're aware of how distracted you are by what's going on around you, you're still cognitive resources that you would otherwise be ploughing into what you're doing are dragged away. And so you're working on 75-80% of capacity if you're not isolated away from other people.
There are, of course, other distractions in the workplace. There have been since men and women first began working together, side by side.
In the 19th and early 20th century, what men want is a private office. That's the sign that they have accomplished something, that they are above the cut of the ordinary man. And what you get with a private office is usually a secretary of your own, or certainly some woman who is supposed to do your bidding. I'm Julie Barabitsky. I'm professor of history and women's and gender studies at the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee. Very quickly, that private space of the private office becomes sexualized. What's going on in there? What happens when that door is closed? And meanwhile, other men are working next to women. They don't have any power over women. Their desks are aligned. They're just doing the busy work of processing paper.
They may just be ordinary workers then and now, but they're also human beings in close proximity, women and men.
That sort of close proximity certainly is filled with flirtatious potential. So I feel like these open plan offices create new dynamics. It makes courtship more public. You see flirtations. Coworkers might catch on to something and say, oh, it looks like Bob and Susie seem to be getting friendly. But by the same token, that constant visibility might mean that people become even more secretive, go to greater lengths to hide that romance.
Might be easier if Susie had her own office.
Yes, exactly.
And perhaps that's one of the problems of the open plan office. The theory may be rigorous, may be quantifiable too. But then along come those complicated humans to fill the building.
Work life is complex, and it's not likely that one single solution will solve all office problems. I would expect, as time goes on, particularly with the ability to be able to communicate at a distance, that there'll be more types, a wider range of ways of working.
I talk about a cafeteria-style office, analogous to the way you think about a cafeteria for food, which is that there's lots of different kinds of food choices, and you select which ones you like for that particular day, that particular meal. And the point is that we need to create the right menu of workspace options for people. Those kind of choices are very important for people to feel some sense of autonomy, to feel that they're able to create a work environment that allows them to be productive.
The challenge for office buildings then is if people are going to actually take the trouble to go on a journey to work, then where they're going to actually has to give them something about other people, something about working collaboratively, because we all now have tools to work alone anywhere. In that case, to actually travel a long distance to be alone seems a little silly. You don't get great symphonies performing if everyone's in little cells. But on the other hand, none of the individual musicians is going to be any good unless they've spent a lot of time alone practicing, refining their art. Then when they come together, wonderful things can happen. So it seems to me that what we now really have to work out is how to have quality open plan areas that are the equivalent of making music in a wonderful symphony orchestra.
You've been listening to Mike Williams talking to Frank Duffy, architect from the United Kingdom. Franklin Becker, social psychologist and professor of design and environmental analysis at Cornell University. Dr. Julie Barabitsky, author of Sex and the Office, A History of Gender, Power and Desire. Professor Alexi Marmot from the Bartlett School at University College London and director of Alexi Marmot Associates Architectural Consultancy. Julian Treasure, author of Sound Business. Dr. Jack Lewis, neuroscientist and broadcaster.